Hello, and welcome to this podcast focusing on bispecific antibodies to treat solid tumors, with a focus on thoracic malignancies. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent online activity, Drs. John Hamak and Ann So will discuss PD-1-CTLA-4, EGFR-PD-1, and DLL3 targeting agents. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from AstraZeneca. In the first segment, Dr. So reviews the classification and mechanism of action of bispecific antibodies.
The title of my talk is The Overview of the PD-1-CTLA-4 Bispecifics in Solid Tumors. I think it's important to take a step back, though, and remember that bispecific antibodies really are a platform. It basically, in essence, means that you've got antibodies that bind to potentially two different antigens or epitopes simultaneously, which can really lead to an anti-tumor effect. There are different ways that we classify the bispecific antibodies, but sometimes I like to say there are non-T-cell engagers or T-cell engagers or BiTEs. For the non-T-cell engagers, these are, in essence, antigen cross-linking antibodies. You can bind to two different antigens on the cancer cell surface, which can ultimately lead to direct tumor cell death. T-cell engagers, or what we call the BiTEs, which are bispecific T-cell engagers, they're designed to basically bring a T-cell over to a tumor cell. So it binds to, for example, a CD3 molecule on a T cell, and then it can go to the tumor-associated antigen on the cancer cells and bring it together for cell death. As you saw in the animation earlier, there are many different important concepts about the mechanisms of actions of the bispecifics, and specifically, the construct of the bispecific antibody is critical in terms of acting against the tumor cells. So many times with the cross-linking of the receptors or the redirection of the immune cells and the dual inhibition of the multiple pathways, and also targeting some of the immune modulatory receptors, we can see differential effects from these different bispecific antibodies. So the dual targeting, what's important to know, as per the animation videos, is that you can get higher specificity, potentially also lower toxicity, with that enhanced anti-tumor activity. The hope is that we can decrease resistance to these drugs, and we can target these multiple pathways and address sometimes the tumor heterogeneity that you tend to see in the solid tumors, not so much in the hematologic malignancies.
In the next segment, Dr. So discusses the PD-1-CTLA-4 targeting bispecific antibodies, volrustomig and cadonilimab.
So volrustomig is also called MEDI-5752, and so this is targeting both CTLA-4 and PD-1. This is important in mesothelioma because the EVOLVE MESO trial is a phase 3 international study looking at using this in combination with chemotherapy in frontline mesothelioma patients. And so the trial schema is here. All patients have to have no prior therapy at all and have a very good performance status, ECOG PS 0 to 1, and they are randomized to chemo alone, or you can receive nivolumab, ipilimumab, these are all FDA-approved frontline regimens, versus carboplatin, pemetrexed, and volrustomig. The primary endpoint is overall survival in the epithelioid mesothelioma population. This is a registration trial, so we are all eagerly anticipating the results, which are anticipated to have a preliminary first look in 2028. Some of the other bispecific antibodies are listed here on this table, but I do want to highlight cadonilimab, simply, or AK-104, simply because this is one of the first bispecific antibodies that were independently developed in China. So there is a global effort for the bispecific antibodies, and this specifically targets PD-1 as well as CTLA-4. As mentioned in the video, is a tetravalent antibody, and so this is unique in its design, and it's specifically designed to improve safety, and that is actually the hope without sacrificing the anti-tumor activity.
In the next segment, Dr. So discusses the rationale for targeting both PD-1 and CTLA-4 with a single drug.
I guess the first question, you know, we've got PD-1 inhibitors, we've got CTLA-4 inhibitors. Why combine them? What's the benefits of putting them into a single construct other than the obvious one of having just a single drug to give?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, John. Well, I think that this is relevant to the entire class of drugs. So when you target PD-1 and CTLA-4, they hit different stages of the immune response. That's a complementary biology. So that's the why for the targets. We know that this dual blockade is effective based off of CheckMate 743 in mesothelioma. But a bispecific antibody really is trying to deliver synergistic effects. So it's potentially a more coordinated engagement. You may have a better therapeutic index than two separate drugs. And so the hope is that we're going to have a more durable benefit, especially in these hard-to-treat subgroups.
Yeah.
In the next segment, Dr. So discusses the future of frontline therapy for mesothelioma.
My experience is everybody eventually gets chemotherapy with mesothelioma that's doing well. So what are your thoughts about starting with PD-1, CTLA-4, and chemotherapy up front? Do you think that's going to eventually be the most effective approach? Or?
Well, I think we'll see with the Evolve Meso study. And I do think, if I'm going to predict, I think all of us are incredibly hopeful that that combination of targeting those dual checkpoint inhibitors as well as chemo might show the best overall survival. So fingers crossed, we'll see.
In the next segment, Dr. Hamak discusses the mechanism of action of VEGF-PD-1 bispecific antibodies and reviews the structure and function of ivonescimab.
You know, so let me talk about this class of drugs first. And this is a really exciting class that is targeting, you know, two targets that we've been thinking about for years, VEGF and PD-1 or PD-L1. Now, just to remind everybody, you know, VEGF, I think, has gained the most notoriety for its role in tumor angiogenesis, you know, particularly for sprouting new vessels. But I think something that hasn't gained as much attention through the years is its role in immune modulation. So VEGF plays a role in Tregs. It helps drive the proliferation and recruitment of myeloid-derived suppressor cells. And it can, you know, play a role in also driving monocytes and the type macrophages that we see in the tumor environment. In fact, overall, we think of VEGF as being immunosuppressive when it comes to anti-tumor immunity. So if you think of blocking both of these pathways together, you know, you can get an effect on angiogenesis. And because it affects vascular permeability, initially, when you block VEGF, you may enhance access into the tumor. You improve the vascular flow, at least transiently. But you also can enhance anti-tumor immunity through effects both on T cells and myeloid-derived suppressors. So this is a really exciting dual blockade that potentially can be synergistic when you're both removing these barriers to anti-tumor immunity, like the Tregs and the myeloid-derived suppressors, and stimulating T effector cells by blocking PD-1. Now, one other effect, and I'll talk a little bit more about this later, is this idea of concentrating the drug in the tumor microenvironment. Because we know VEGF is much higher in the tumor microenvironment, tumors typically have to make VEGF to grow a blood supply. So if you've got these drugs that bind VEGF, and they do it in a way that is bivalent, where you get something we call daisy chaining. So you've got one molecule here of the bispecific binding one monomer of VEGF, another one binding the other monomer. So VEGF sort of connects them, and you get a concentration of the drug that forms multimers. And that's been shown that it can bind PD-1 more effectively as well. So you're not just looking at single molecules binding PD-1, you're getting a whole multimer or complex of binding antibodies. So there's really multiple different ways that you can get synergy by blocking these two targets together. So the first drug, and I think the one we have the most data about right now, is ivonescimab, earlier known as AK-112. And so this is really a first-in-class VEGF PD-1 bispecific antibody. So again, this is tetravalent, so it has two VEGF binding moieties. Each one combined a VEGF monomer, and VEGF is normally a dimer, so you get this connectivity happening or a daisy chaining effect. The PD-1 binding to ivonescimab enhances the affinity to the VEGF and vice versa. So to explain that, when VEGF is present, it blocks PD-1 more effectively, but because it forms these multimers. And when PD-1 is present, it's a more potent VEGF binder. So you can see from these preclinical studies that it really can act in a synergistic way. And this is one that's Fc null. So the antibody functions that are dependent on that Fc binding, like the ADCC and CDC, are abrogated. And we think that gives it a better safety profile. Now, this is one that has a sort of intermediate half-life. It isn't as long as some of the VEGF binders like bevacizumab, which we think of as being a few weeks, but it's not as short as some of the T-cell engagers, on the order of 6 to 7 days.
In the next segment, Dr. Hamak reviews ongoing phase 3 studies of ivonescimab with a detailed discussion of Harmony A.
So there's a whole suite of different phase 3 trials with ivonescimab that are ongoing. I'll talk briefly about Harmony A, and then we have the Harmony study itself with the same regimen. Harmony 2, which is monotherapy in patients that are PD-L1 positive. Harmony 3 are chemotherapy combinations, and that's compared to pembrolizumab plus chemotherapy. And Harmony 7 is ivonescimab versus pembrolizumab, and this is just high PD-L1 greater than 50%. So really, the bases are covered for non-small cell lung cancer. So first, let me discuss Harmony A. Now, Harmony A is the combination of chemotherapy with ivonescimab versus chemotherapy alone for patients here with non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer who had an activating EGFR mutation. Now, it's worth reminding everybody, this population, PD-1 inhibitors with chemotherapy have never proven to be effective. There have been trials testing pembrolizumab and nivolumab with chemo, and they did not add significant benefits. So those are not approved regimens. So that's why the comparator arm here is chemotherapy alone. The primary endpoint here was progression-free survival by independent review, IRC. Secondary endpoints included overall survival, response rate, duration of response, and so forth. Now, about 161 patients per arm. Arms were relatively well-balanced overall between the two arms. It's worth noting over 20% of patients had brain metastasis. So this is really similar to what we see in a real-world population for EGFR mutant patients who've already progressed after a TKI. So if we look now here at the PFS, it did achieve its primary endpoint of prolonging PFS. And you see a median PFS here of 7.1 months versus 4.8 months. PFS hazard ratio of 0.46. A higher response rate as well at 50.6 versus 35.4%. Now we know for EGFR mutant tumors, the two classic mutations, L858R and exon 19 deletion, have markedly different outcomes to TKIs like osimertinib. But here, the exon 19 deletion and L858R both experienced a pretty similar degree of benefit in terms of the hazard ratio. Now, what about patients with brain metastasis? And again, this is a huge problem with patients with EGFR mutations. Well, again, a similar degree of benefits for patients with and without brain metastasis, and no new safety signals emerging there as well. So, really, Harmony A shows us a broad PFS benefit for different populations we care about in this EGFR mutant population. Now, overall survival is not fully mature yet, but we do see a trend favoring the ivonescimab arm with a hazard ratio of 0.8, and you see the median overall survival about 3 months different. Now, what about adverse events? Well, I think there were no real new safety signals, and overall, not large differences between the ivonescimab and placebo arm, with a couple of anticipated exceptions to that. We see some differences in terms of decreased appetite, asthenia, proteinuria, again, a VEGF effect, and hypoalbuminemia, again, a VEGF effect. But when we look at the discontinuation rate, relatively similar at 5.6 versus 2.5%. And in this setting, we commonly think of less than 10% as a discontinuation rate consistent with drugs that we commonly are using on a day-to-day basis. So on this basis, the drug was approved in China in 2024, and this fed into the global phase 3 HARMONY study as well.
In the next segment, Dr. Heymach discusses the phase 3 HARMONY 2 study.
So I think as we think about HARMONY 2, you know, we already have three PD-1 or L1 inhibitors approved as monotherapy. So do we really need another? And is there any mechanistic reason to think that ivonescimab might be different than just another PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor as well? So this is the HARMONY 2 design. It's ivonescimab versus pembrolizumab, but this is in the greater than 1%. And the study was stratified for 1 to 49 versus the greater than 50. Now, it's important to note that the PFS here was judged by the independent review, not by investigators. And so the strengths of this, it's a randomized phase 3 design. It has an independent review, and it was powered really to see a pretty large benefit. In fact, to be honest, there was a larger benefit than I anticipated we ended up seeing. The downside here, I think, from a U.S. perspective in interpreting these results, is HARMONY 2 is all China enrollment, although you've heard about HARMONY 7 that's going on in the rest of the world. Now, the arms were well balanced here, particularly with the greater than 50 and 1 to 49% enrollment. And, you know, the last thing is pembro the right comparator for this 1 to 49 subgroup? Well, remind everybody in the KEYNOTE-042, pembro monotherapy was better than chemotherapy, although the benefit was a little bit more modest here than we see in the chemotherapy combinations for this 1 to 49 subgroup. So if you look at the KEYNOTE-189, a more robust difference was observed. So I think in the U.S., more commonly in the 1 to 49 chemotherapy combinations are what we're using. Well, here's the primary endpoint. And this really, I think, showed a striking and to me, somewhat surprising difference between ivonescimab and pembrolizumab. You know, a difference of over 5 months in median PFS, hazard ratio for PFS of 0.51, and highly statistically significant here. So really a striking PFS difference. Now, you know, is there an explanation? You know, do we see that there's some particular group that had the most benefit, or pembro might have just had a bad day? Well, if we look at pembrolizumab, its performance here in the HARMONY 2, median PFS was 5.8 months. And in the KEYNOTE-042 here in a worldwide study, median PFS was 5.4 months. So pembro performed as it typically does, actually slightly better in this population. So underperformance of pembro is not the explanation for the results here. Now, it was also intriguing to see that if we look at the 1 to 49 or the greater than 50%, the benefits are very similar between ivonescimab and the pembrolizumab. The relative difference was relatively similar. And the same with squamous versus non-squamous. So really, benefits for PFS were seen for ivonescimab versus pembro really across the board here. So we can't really single out one group where the difference was most striking. Now, was there a big difference in toxicities? I think the answer is there is an increase in serious treatment-related adverse events, 20.8 versus 16.1. I think we'd regard that as a pretty modest difference. But if you look at the ones leading to discontinuation, it's actually slightly lower in the ivonescimab arm. And when you look at the things that are really different, when you compare the two, we see proteinuria and hypertension. Again, those are established VEGF side effects, so consistent with what we think the drug would be doing. And we know those are not things that are typically causing patients to discontinue. They typically can be managed in the clinic. So overall, my feeling is there's a manageable safety profile, and it's consistent with taking a PD-1 inhibitor and getting a VEGF inhibitor there.
In the next segment, Dr. Hamak discusses the bispecific T-cell engager, tarlatamab.
You'll recall tarlatamab now is a molecule that's been FDA approved, and it binds to DLL3. Now, DLL3 is present commonly on small cell and other neuroendocrine type tumors and some other types as well. And it binds to the T cell, CD3, and it's a bit like in a forced marriage here. It takes the T cell and puts it into a synapse with the small cell. This is important because even though small cell has a high mutational burden, it tends to be pretty cold in terms of having very few T cells present in there. So we really need to give the immune system some help by getting more T cells into the tumor microenvironment. All right, now for safety, and Dr. So mentioned some of these concerns before, we've really got a couple of things to really pay attention to. With tarlatamab, you very quickly are mounting a large immune response. You're bringing a lot of T cells into a bulky tumor environment commonly, and that creates a lot of immune response very quickly. So with that early tumor cell death, you get a lot of cytokines released, and this is the cytokine release syndrome. And there's really two areas to think about. One, these cytokines can cause leakiness, we think, in the blood-brain barrier. And that's the ICANS, the neurologic syndrome you can get. And really, the things to be looking out for, as Dr. So mentioned, headache, confusion, delirium, seizures. Now, sometimes patients don't report all these things accurately. They may, they just may report not feeling well or maybe being a little headachy, but you really have to probe a bit to find out that they could be confused, and sometimes seizures can just come on all of a sudden. So really, physicians giving these drugs have to be hyper-vigilant for the neurologic syndromes. You also have the broader cytokine release syndrome systemically, and that can cause vascular leakage, fevers, rigors, hypoxia, hypotension, tachycardia, myalgias, arthralgias. So there's a lot that can go along with that. And we think some of these are mediated by cytokines like IL-6. It's possible VEGF mediates some of these effects as well.
In the next segment, Dr. Hamak discusses recognizing and managing toxicities unique to bispecific T-cell engagers.
In your presentation, you mentioned, how important multidisciplinary care is for like tarlatamab, but can you double click on that a little bit more about the benefits? Because I think this is such an important issue.
I think, with drugs like tarlatamab, we're really seeing an unprecedented benefit in terms of what looks like a survival benefit. I mean, the data is early, but it's bringing a whole new modality of treatment that patients haven't had access to. This isn't just another chemo drug or, and so forth. So I think that's a huge upside. But with it, it requires an entirely different type of management than chemotherapy does. And even though chemotherapy has a lot of side effects, there are side effects we're used to managing, right? All of our multidisciplinary care teams, from infusion nurses and our teams that work in the clinic, are used to dealing with chemotherapy side effects. These are side effects that we don't have the same comfort with. I think our colleagues in the heme world have a head start with us on this. So I think the key for the managing the T cell engagers in particular is having a multidisciplinary staff that really has been educated about the side effects, what to look for, how to educate patients, because some of these side effects are really subtle early on, like a little bit of confusion or a little bit of headache. Now, under normal circumstances, that might be something a patient might, think is the flu, right? It's something that
Easy
they
to
feel they can
ignore.
stick out, but here we really need for them to be fully sensitized that that may be an early sign of CRS, and the key is intervening early, not waiting for it to get to a hard situation. And I will tell you, and Dr. So, I'm sure you've got patients like this. You have some patients that often don't want to bother their care team unless things become really, really
Like
hard.
dire.
And I have to tell them, listen, don't try to be a hero here. Let us know, the minute you have any of these side effects, and you want your care team to be able to recognize that for T cell engagers, these symptoms really require hospitalization and inpatient management. I think one can start with steroids in the outpatient setting, like dexamethasone. But if you have early signs of ICANS or CRS, my feeling is this really needs to be managed in an inpatient setting by people that are familiar with the side effects. So.
In the final segment, Dr. Hamak discusses the potential future impact of bispecific antibodies on the treatment of thoracic malignancies.
Well, I'm not going to ask you to pick a drug. I do want you to think about in the crystal ball, where in general do you think the bispecific antibodies and BiTEs will be fitting? Like, what settings do you think they're going to make the greatest impact?
Yeah. If you look at that landscape of non-small cell lung cancer, we think about really the PD-1 VEGFs have shown benefits so far in the PD-L1 positive, the 1 to 49 and the greater than 50. And in the EGFR mutants, we did see at least a PFS benefit in the Harmony A study and in the broader Harmony study. Now, I think the survival benefits clearly are trending in the right direction, but have not hit their predefined statistical bar yet from the Harmony study. But there's clearly benefit translating there. So I do think in the PD-L1 positive tumors as monotherapy, it looks like there will be benefit. I think in the oncogene-driven tumors like EGFR that we know are very VEGF dependent. I believe there potentially can be benefit as well. And I am hopeful that the chemotherapy combinations, will show benefit, especially in squamous. The early studies for squamous have been very promising. And squamous is an area where we have not made as much progress as we have for non-squamous lung cancer. So those are areas where I am hopeful in the near term we're going to see benefits. Now, it's not the only drugs that are poised to make benefit. We have a whole raft of new ADCs coming along. We have other checkpoint inhibitors coming along and things like LAG-3 and so forth. But these are good problems. This is what we want to see. We want our life to be hard because we have so many beneficial drugs to choose from.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.